You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. When we're in the midst of a great cultural divide and surrounded by what feels like an unending stream of hateful rhetoric, it can be hard to imagine a better future. But that's just what Penumbra Theater asked Minnesotans to do with its My America project. Last fall, the St. Paul Theater Company put out a call for people to share their experiences of our country and their visions for what it could and should be. From close to 100 submissions, 12 people were selected from across the state to work with Penumbra to develop their writing for the stage. Several of them will be presenting their pieces tonight before a live audience. This hour, we're going to hear a few of them and talk about the collective vision they create. I should note, Minnesota Public Radio is a sponsor of Penumbra's My America. Joining me in studio this morning is Penumbra Theater Artistic Director Sarah Bellamy. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Marianne.
We're also joined by My America participant and actress Isabella LeBlanc. Isabella, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Bellamy, what inspired you to launch the My America project?
Well, I think one of the things that we're trying to do and was foremost in my mind as I came into my artistic directorship at Penumbra is to really fully activate Penumbra's mission. And we do what we call art for social change. So the work that we create on our stages is intended to provoke thought, but also to get people moving, get people active. And 2 years ago, we launched our first civic engagement campaign. And the idea is to use the art to inspire people to, you know, get involved in our community, to pay more attention to what's going on, to vote, to be involved civically. And so we were looking around at the world that we saw and we thought, you know, it's really important that we step forward into a space with courage and compassion and really try to engender a space of conversation and dialogue.
Hmm. Were you surprised by the results?
I think what's most amazing to me about this campaign is, well, there are so many amazing things. Obviously, that so many people wanted to participate was tremendous. That the submissions came from literally all across the state. You know, the diversity of that group was incredible. We had 6 men and women who are living in prisons in Minnesota who sent in submissions. We had people from Bemidji, from Pine Island. Our youngest submission came from a 14-year-old. We had people in their 80s submit stories. So I think, you know, people really do want to share and they're passionate about their Minnesota experience and their experience with our country right now. And as we were reading, it was so difficult to choose, you know, 12. But I think what's common about all of the participants who went through that writing process with us is their courage and their clarity about who they are and their authentic connection to their own community and, you know, the voice that they bring to this process is singular and unique, and it would be different if they weren't with us.
Hmm. Isabella LeBlanc, what compelled you to submit a piece for My America?
You know, I think there are a couple different reasons. I think as a Indigenous person, I come from a community where we're often not part of the conversation, and that's part of what I love about theater and what draws me to theater is that I get to be a voice and I get to be heard. And so when I saw that Penumbra had this call out, it immediately made me think about how most of the conversations I've been having with my family and with my community about this point in time in our country is that all these conversations about where we should go moving forward should be rooted in better conversations about our past. And it made me really reflect on my experiences in high school, specifically American history classes. And it felt like a good opportunity to talk about those experiences, especially since I worked with Penumbra when I was in high school and I was able to write a monologue with them. And I look back on them as being a key part in my journey in high school for talking about my experiences as a Native person. And so this felt like a perfect opportunity to do that again.
Well, we had the opportunity to record you and others performing your pieces. So let's hear Isabella's piece.
Proposed adjustments to American history curriculum. 1. My classmates sound like streams. They take turns reciting textbook quotations. Their words are garbled like a river current. Swift and monotonous. I envy how easy this is for them, how light their voices sound, because for me this class is heavy. covered like thick smoke on water. I'm the only Native kid in this school. And I'm reminded that school to my grandmother was boarding school, education that stole you from home and told you to forget your headwaters. Why do I feel that legacy in this classroom? 2. American history felt like reliving 1,000 of my old lives. I was 17, but I felt 500 years older. I already knew I was history incarnated, treaties and massacres made flesh. I knew that being indigenous in America means carrying history no one else wants to hold. And that's why the concrete textbook felt hollow. Because for every single leaded page glued into its spine, there were 10, 20, 30 more that had been omitted, discarded in mass graves and prison cells, kept out of view in museum archives. I was tired of searching for these forgotten pages alone, of carrying my trauma like a secret. So I told my teacher, and then my principal, and then the head of school. I told them that American history takes bodies like mine and eats them whole. But instead of open ears and open palms, the head of school hid behind a textbook and a big wooden table and said, "I don't understand the problem. This is an American history class, not a Native history class." 3. The bell rings and I bring my head above water. I've held my breath for 1 hour and 15 minutes. This is my ceremony, my daily self-preservation ritual, because when they told me I had no choice but to sit in this pressurized room, I wanted to scream, but I was afraid my lungs weren't strong enough. So I decided to be silent instead. So today I entered the classroom the same as I do every day. I anchored myself to the shore as my classmates cascaded down streams. 4. When I was 17, I chose silence. I held my truths close to my heart. I sealed them in glass so as not to crush them. But I am no longer 17. And with every year that passes and every time this country breaks my heart, I am a little less willing to accept what they wanted to teach me. That this history is not my history, this country not my country, because I am no longer 17, but I am reminded of those who are. Those who are sitting quietly in classrooms, who hope there is a country out there with a spot for them at the table, a choir to sing with their voice. I am reminded that if we are teaching them anything other than the fact that this country is their birthright, we are failing them. So maybe I'll write a letter, and I'll title it "Proposed Adjustments to American History Curriculum," and I'll send it to the head of school. In the letter, I will describe the American history class I wish I'd been in, the one every kid deserves to be in. In my class, no one would feel small or alone. No one would feel like this country's history means they're not part of its future, because my class would be a Native history class, and it would be a Black history class, and an Asian history class, and a Latino history class, and a women's history class, because that is my America. It is Native and Black and brown, Christian and Muslim and Jewish. My America is queer and disabled and poor, and you can never separate those parts. Because my America is time immemorial. It's trees that are tall enough to see the future, to see that we are stronger than the last 500 years of trauma combined. My America is knowing that this land has known love for longer than it has known hate. My America is learning to remember.
That was Isabella LeBlanc's Proposed Adjustments to American History Curriculum, which she'll also be reading tonight on stage at Penumbra Theater in St. Paul as part of the theater's My America project. Isabella, thank you for that. So what were your expectations coming into this program?
I don't think I knew what to expect. I mean, going into our first workshop, I didn't know the artists I would be working with, and I knew that it was an open call from across the state and really with the intention of getting a diverse group of experiences. So I think I was a little nervous, because especially when we're talking about such personal stories and I had no idea who would be in the room and what they would understand, what they wouldn't. So I think really it was a lot of not knowing what to expect and not knowing what was going to happen.
And then you end up being in this room. There are 12 people in the group, mm-hmm. and they range in age from 14 to 74. They're all different racial backgrounds. You had three pretty intense weekends together working on your pieces, working on getting them ready to perform them in front of an audience. What was that like?
It was so incredible. And I think, again, very intense, but in such a fulfilling and nurturing way. I felt like I came home from every workshop feeling uplifted, which felt really special and really unique. And I don't know if I've ever been in a space quite like this one before and had these kind of experiences and these kind of conversations with people I had really just met. But from literally the first day, probably the first 10 minutes, we had bonded and started conversations in a way I have never experienced before.
Why do you think that is? How did that happen?
I mean, I think because of the nature of the project and the nature of the fact that we all had to submit, I think we were just a group that is tired of not having these conversations. And we were ready to be in a room with people who are willing to listen and speak our truths. And that was very special.
Sarah, in terms of the desired outcome, it seems like exactly what you would want to have is to have people come together. Were you surprised at how they gelled? Or because I know you do some work around this outside of the theater, et cetera. You have workshops, you do trainings.
Yeah. I think, I'm thrilled to hear that that was your experience, Isabella. And we've heard that from a number of the participants. I think that it is a tribute to a couple of things. One, this is what artists should do. Artists should come together and create community. They should challenge our ideas. They should bravely create space. And so we wanted to empower them to do that. We also were really intentional about the submission process, you know, making sure that we had translated our call to submit in several languages. We had a diverse group of readers. You know, we brought people to the table whose opinions we respect and who are respected by their community and seen as leaders. And so they were informing how we were selecting people. And I think, honestly, the process that we undergo creatively at Penumbra to uplift story and uplift voice and center people of color is infused throughout this entire thing. So, I myself was that first 10 minutes, I was like, wow, this is going to be very intense because they went there. But I think it, you know.
Yeah, that first day, that first
weekend. Oh, my goodness. I mean, it was wild. But I also really think people have been carrying so much because they aren't included. They aren't invited to the table. And so when they come, they just, it pours out of them. And that creates brave space because they themselves are courageous and brave. And I'm so thrilled that we had such a powerful container to hold that space. Our four facilitators were tremendous. Sarah Myers, Aaron Sharkey, Lisa Brimmer, and David Melendez. Our producer on this project, Shayla Rowland, created an incredible space. And the cool thing for me about the civic engagement campaigns at Penumbra is that they have the fingerprints and the heart prints of our entire staff on it. Everybody has to help out.
Yeah. You mentioned Shayla Rowland, the associate producer at Penumbra Theater. She managed the My America project, and I had a chance to talk with her. I asked her what she wants the participants to take away from it. Here's what she said.
I hope they take away some power to continue telling their story. I hope that they take away the tools of sharing space with others, the tools of writing and revision and all of that, but the tools of talking to people that you may not know, of relating to people. I think some of the things that they, in writing, like the revision and the criticism and critiquing of other folks in pieces is valuable even outside of writing. Just how we talk to folks constructively as people is really important. But I really do hope that they take away some reassurance in the power of their voice, the power of their story. I think some of them, as I listened to everybody else share their stories, were struck by the similarities or hearing that I am not alone. I'm not the only person who's ever felt this, and that they continue to share their stories knowing that there are other people out there who have also felt this, who may not feel confident or who may feel scared in sharing their stories. I just hope they take away a beautiful memory of all the weekends, and that that feeling of joy, but of challenge and of process and progress stays with them as they move forward.
That's Penumbra Associate Producer Shayla Rowland. Isabella, do you feel like your voice is stronger now because of this experience?
Oh, definitely. As a writer, again, because I have done minimal writing outside of this process. But again, like Shayla said, just in my overall life, I feel like I have much less desire to be in spaces that won't uplift me like this. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be in rooms like this, and I know now I'm going to actively seek out being in situations like this one.
But I think, too, that you know, ideally people after having an experience like this, the participants and hopefully the audience who comes tonight, they will not only seek out those spaces, but they'll seek to create those spaces. They will demand those spaces. And that's what, at the end of the day, the Civic Engagement Campaign is about. It's about, I've seen this version of myself. I've seen this version of my community. I've seen this version, this vision of America, and I am going to work to make it happen.
I find it interesting that a lot of, when you're talking about My America and talking about how it's about speaking truths, but also creating a vision, that in many ways the essays were pulling together the truths, but it was the process of bringing them together and putting them on stage that was more sort of acting out the vision of having people's voices heard and putting them, you know, getting them in front of an audience. It seems like the process, as much as the product, was about, the work of Penumbra was in doing in part what was being called for in the essays, too.
Yeah. It's interesting that you note that, because that's the way that we teach in our Summer Institute program, which is where we train young activist artists. It is a process-oriented program. Yes, the final product is amazing. Yes, you will come and watch these children and cry and, you know, get all snotty, and you will leave feeling so inspired. And that's what's going to happen tonight if you come bring Kleenex. But at the end of the day, I don't think what we're trying to do is create a perfect story or tell everybody's story. We're saying, tell your story as bravely, as authentically, as truthfully, as courageously as you can. And when you do that, someone else will hear themselves in that, and they will be surprised, but they will feel welcomed. And that is what we do at Penumbra. That's the spirit of the mission. Mm.
You mentioned earlier, I mean, we had 12 participants in this program, but you mentioned earlier that 12 submissions came from prisons. And so there are actually only 11 people who are attending this workshop, because you had one participant who was participating from incarceration. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how that worked?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I, again, this is, as I said earlier, Shayla ran this project so beautifully, and she was so thoughtful and intentional about maintaining space for this particular person. I found myself continuously frustrated with the rules and regulations that we came up against in dealing with someone who's incarcerated. And every time that I came up against one of those rules, I was reminded of two things. One, my own privilege, and two, my frustration was motivating me to work to change things. And so, you know, I think that...
What were some of those frustrations?
You know, it's...
Access.
Whether or not you can you can mention someone's name, whether or not you can show a picture of that individual. You know, that what the prison system intends to do is to make you a non-person for the duration of the time that you're incarcerated. And, you know, growing up, especially in an environment like a theater, which is all about empathy and voice and witness, I mean, that just felt like such injustice and such a soul-crushing reality. And so what Shayla did, and what I'm so proud of her for doing in the whole project, but in particular with regard to this participant, is just make sure that she was in the room in some way, that our facilitators kept lifting up her experience, lifting up her voice, and not even speaking for her, but just saying, remember, there's a voice that's not at the table today. And I don't know what that experience was like for the participants in the room, but from my perspective, that just felt like a really important commitment.
Yeah, and paying visits to the prison to make sure that people were getting, you know, that this person was getting the feedback, et cetera. Isabella, what was it like for you in terms of trying to hold space for a person who wasn't there at the table?
Yeah, it was, again, it was a very important part of the process, again, because we were so close-knit as a group and so much was happening in these rooms. And I think it was really important for us to have moments that were like, okay, let's, again, hold space for the people who can't be here right now. And if that's our other participant, if that's other people in our state that, you know, haven't quite been given the same opportunity we have. And it felt really powerful to then come together and we would write notes to the participant that couldn't be there. We read their piece. And it was just about, you know, making sure that we were also thinking outside of our bubble.
I thought it was interesting that of the finalists, 10 were women and 2 were men. Sarah, why do you think there was that gender imbalance?
I mean, you know, first of all of the participants were selected anonymously. So we didn't know their demographic information.
Really?
No. All of the people who were kind of who made their way into the second review process, that was anonymous. And then as we started thinking about whose voices we wanted to uplift, it was about, you know, challenging our understanding of not just our country, but also our state, right? Like, people think of Minnesota, and many, many people across the country think of Prairie Home Companion, which is a beautiful, you know, storytelling process, but it's also from a very particular perspective. And so we thought, what does Minnesota actually look like today? And how are all of those communities able to come to this table? And so I think we tried to be really thoughtful about the diversity that we were inviting and hoping to eventually share the stage with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we were challenged by that. It's the same in Summer Institute too. I mean, I don't know, maybe women are just a little more intrepid in their creative endeavors. And but I don't know. We often have more female participants in this work than male identified
participants. Easier to share for some reason. Yeah.
Maybe.
Mm. We're talking today with Penumbra Theater Artistic Director Sarah Bellamy and Isabella LeBlanc about My America, and we'd love to hear from you. What vision do you have for our country moving forward? What are your hopes for America? You can join the conversation, respond to some of what you've heard here at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can call us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Let's hear another piece. Here's Rebecca Crisanta de Ibarra reading The Crocodile Story.
I am as Minnesotan as anyone else I know. Half Scandinavian, Norwegian, and half indigenous, Xinka-Lenca tribe of El Salvador. Immigrants on both sides, my roots come from the countrysides of the Midwest and the Balsam Coast, from the waters of the Blue Pacific and the fjords, from the Bigfoot Bluffs and the volcanoes. I grew up cruising to football games with white kids in pickups in Austin, Minnesota, Spamtown, USA, a meatpacking town where indigenous Mexican immigrants processed pork for engorged American appetites, where on a hot, windy day, the air is so thick you can taste it, pig's blood and excrement and the sweat inside tears inside of brown dreams, living somewhere in the throat, an itch you can't scratch, where you hear the pig screams as the trucks roll in, like Edvard Munch, like they already know their fate. My family cried when immigrant friends went home to Oaxaca with unidentified pig brain encephalitis. Para ver al curandero, they said, to see the healer at home and then come back home. To be an immigrant is an in-between unknown. The Aztecs called it nepantla, the in-between haziness between one and another, like the horizon between night and day, between poverty and hope. I spent some time traveling to meet my relatives in Latin America. I'd get the customary question, where are you from? And I'd answer, America. I was always met with a fight that I was unconscious to as a second-generation immigrant. Of course you're American, so are we all, they'd say. But where are you from? And I didn't know, because I certainly wasn't the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Barbie I saw on TV. And I didn't know all the words to Las Mañanitas either. When I was exhausted or fell down and scraped my knee, I didn't say ufta or hijoles, but a combination of the two, uftale. I was somewhere in the middle, on the border, battling inside of the biracial frontera, a microcosm of white supremacy, violence, oppression, and neglect inside of one body, one soul, lost. A spiritual warfare unseen. I didn't claim America, and it didn't claim me either. My family was always nostalgic about their home countries, and wherever we lived just seemed like a stop on the way to somewhere else. See, on both sides of my immigrant history, there was no American dream to get to, more like a nightmare to get away from. My Norwegian grandmother shipped back to the fjords from homesickness. Even now, my cousins visit the Midwest every year and swiftly return to Norway because there is no way they would stay here. Why would they give up all they have there for the uneasiness of the USA and an uncertain future? Covert, unruly, unreliable to its citizens. My father had no choice but to leave El Salvador as a refugee. A country torn apart by U.S. imperial greed, fed $1 million a day in war crimes and School of the Americas torture techniques. A country of orphans left behind like Lord of the Flies. The same ones used today with twisted faces to describe sh-hole countries. Uftale. A place where indigenous rebellion meets quietly in the night, or else be silenced in broad daylight. Divide and conquer, conquer and divide, but just survive. Just survive. When I'm not sure where I'm from anymore, after all this time, it's the land itself that calls to me from my ancestors. This is a story my ancestors used to tell. A long time ago, water covered the whole world, and giants roamed the earth. There were giant turtles and giant fish, giant birds and giant crocodiles. But there was no place for small animals or flowers or humans. One day a council in the sky said, "Our creation is almost perfect, but we're missing something. We need a place for the small animals, plants, and humans. Who will build it?" One great-grandmother crocodile stepped forward to volunteer. So she laid down into the water and rose up with her back. And the bumps on her crocodile back turned into mountains and islands, and the cracks in between turned into valleys, rivers, and streams. Her skin turned to mud, and out of the mud grew the first precious flowers. Her whole body stretched from the top of North America to the tip of her tail at the bottom of South America. And on her back lived the people. We remember her name as Emish, water lily crocodile, the great-grandmother who gave her life to give us Earth, and we call her Las Americas. Today, the land of the Caiman is ripped in half and she bleeds, and I'm somewhere in the middle, sewing the wound, covered in blood, crocodile tears, covered in lies that we have somehow not been here before, that my ancestors didn't know these stars. It's a truth lying in wait that we are not immigrants to this land. We are relatives, waiting for reconnection, recognition. No somos inmigrantes, somos indígena. We are indigenous. We are already American, and the land is free. It comforts me to know that when I'm feeling stuck in the belly of the beast, that my family somewhere in the entrails of the crocodile looks up at the same moon I see from somewhere in her heart, that my people knew a long time ago of nations not fractured by borders but connected by friendships. Guancasco, fraternity of royal jaguars and resplendent birds, tongues out, dancing together.
That was Rebecca Crisanta de Ibarra reading The Crocodile Story. What a beautiful piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many of these people came to you as writers already fully formed, Sarah? I mean, these seemed like such fully formed voices, and they have such amazing descriptive stories to tell. What was sort of the range and ability that they came with?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the things that we try to challenge at Penumbra is the idea of when you get to claim the title of an artist, right? And we talked about that. In fact, we invited David Mura to the table to talk with the participants about, you know, just get that out of the way. You write. You're here.
Yeah, great local Asian American writer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was wonderful that he was able to do that. And I think, you know, certainly people came in with experience. But, you know, I think this process challenged everybody because it wasn't your typical process to write with community, to write with this community, and to write with the idea in mind that you would eventually be sharing this with people in service of creating a more hopefully inclusive and compassionate America.
Isabella, did you think of yourself as a writer before this?
Definitely not.
Again,
really? Yeah. I had done monologues with Penumbra when I was in high school. I did some other things in high school. I've done spoken word a little bit, but I definitely feel more in my comfort zone as an actor reading other people's words than my own.
You do know you're a writer now, though, right?
Oh, thank you.
And she'll be performing it on stage tonight as well. Sarah Bellamy, a lot of these pieces deal with identity, whether it's about race or ability or class. Looking at them as a whole, were there themes that emerged for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the most prominent theme for me is whether or not these are the people that are invited to the table. I think there's a yearning for each voice to be included. There's also something that's really interesting in the stories about this insider-outsider status and the idea of what it means to think about an America that includes everyone, but also the America that I need to be safe, right? My America needs some privacy for certain people because the world, this country is not safe for everyone right now. Some of our community members are in danger in the most mundane moments. And that is part of what we're hoping to address tonight with not only the art that we're putting forward, but the panel of people who are coming to the table to kind of say, let's roll up our sleeves and let's think about how we can make our communities more safe for everyone.
Hmm. Isabella, did you find that you and the other writers had more in common than you first realized?
Oh, definitely. Again, we all came from very different backgrounds and have very different jobs and do very different things in our day-to-day life. But I kept finding that in these conversations we had, it felt like we were coming from the exact same place, from the exact same experiences. But then also not. Again, there was this loveliness in how different our perspectives were and how they fed off of each other and how they intersected and how they didn't.
Was there a moment that particularly surprised you in those 3 weekends?
I don't know if I could pick a specific moment, but I can think of many, many conversations of just sitting down and speaking one-on-one with some of my peers and just realizing that we don't get to have conversations like this all the time, not only in content, but just in depth. I'm not used to, in my everyday life, just sitting down with someone and talking about trauma and talking about, you know, the communities that we come from and the people that we love. Like, connecting on that level is so special and so appreciated.
What was the hardest part for you about this project?
I think the hardest part for me was allowing myself to show up in very vulnerable ways. I think a lot of us experience this, and I know I'm definitely guilty of it, is that I'm good at showing up in superficial ways sometimes, and that I can enter a room and I can interact with people and engage with people, but not bring the hard stuff or maybe the uncomfortable stuff. And so my peers in this group really pushed me that they were so open and vulnerable with their experiences and what they were willing to talk about, that it really pushed me to go to places that I'm not usually ready to go to.
Hmm. Moving forward, Sarah, do you see this project happening again?
Very likely, yeah. I mean, I think, so as I'm listening to Isabella, who so eloquently describes this experience, I think to myself, this is the experience of being human and of making spaces more humane, and that is what art should do. And it, I think, is also what democracy should do. And it is in realizing that none of us come into this world alone. We're all carrying our histories on our backs. We're carrying our families. We're carrying their successes, their failures, their hopes, their crushed dreams, that all of that is showing up in our bodies, in our DNA. And we feel accountable to that. And sometimes that can be very debilitating. But when you encounter a brave space where another person is saying, I'll listen, tell me, what's it like? How can I help? I feel like that's what we should be doing as a nation, you know, and that's a practice that each one of us can certainly try to take on. And Minnesotans definitely need to try because, you know, this idea of like you know, a Minnesotan will invite you anywhere but to your home,
yeah,
to their
right.
home.
Yeah.
You know, we could show up less superficially for each other. I know I certainly could and hope to challenge myself to do that. But I think that, yes, Marianne, Penumbra is committed to continuing to uplift story. And we hope that that people will continue to share their stories with us. We're so blessed to be able to do this work.
We have time for just one more story. So let's hear from Wendy.
My name is Wendy Thompson Taiwo, and the name of my piece is Black is a Country. Daughter. Although you are only 7, there are things about this life that you will need to know, and it's best that I be the one to tell you. One of the most important things you will need to know, that you will need to remember, is who you are and what it means to be Black in America. To be Black in America in this moment. According to statistics, we can determine the length, value, and quality of Black life in relation to the rest of the nation. According to statistics, the average Black household would need 228 years to accumulate as much wealth as the average white household. Black infant death is 2 times higher than that of whites, and Black folks are incarcerated at more than 5 times the rate of whites, despite us making up less than 13% of the nation. According to statistics, one might begin to believe that we Black people are averse to work, no good with money, careless with our health, and bent on our own destruction. Falsehoods that white folks use to both chastise us and convince us that we can escape social death if only we cut down on our Starbucks and lottery spending, went to our appointments on time, ate healthier organic meals, and drove less suspiciously within the speed limit. If we did all that, they assure us, we'd be better, worthier people, Black and human. But they won't tell you that their rainy day funds were built on our perpetual underpayment, or that their job security means our unemployment. They won't tell you that the protection of their children requires our constant surveillance and their comfort requires our containment. This is to say we have been socialized. Has your teacher taught you that word yet? Socialized, when a society decides it needs a social group to be a certain way. Dominant, easily controlled, a distraction, disposable, it makes them that way. We as Black folks have been socialized to accept the foreclosure of our humanity and in the process do asinine, self-defeating, harmful things like rushing to collect a white woman's tears in public, knowing full well their potential for getting Black folks hanged, sentenced, or fired, or letting debt get the upper hand over history and watching the sale of your great-grandparents' house, the one they first bought when they moved west from Louisiana, right up from under your great-grandmother's dead body. Or pardoning the people whose distress calls send so many of our people to the morgue. At once, these things tell us that we are both lucky to be alive and that there is nowhere safe in this nation for me to raise you and for you to be a Black child. By now, I know that safety belongs to white people, but that doesn't mean I don't also wish for you and your brother to be safe. And by safe, I mean a place where you will not be robbed of your individuality and wrapped around white people's assumptions, punished for white people's fears. By safe, I mean a place where you can wear your hair, each strand kinetic, an orb of Blackness suspended around your head, your crown of glory, without messy, uninvited hands going through it like a tactile exhibit or a piece of public art. By safe, I mean a place where I don't have to tell you that another Black person was killed today by the police. Yes, like that officer who was invited to talk to your school today about public safety. Since its inception, this country has been a Black horror story where we Black people play both the one Black character who we all know will be the first to die and the audience that shouts to the soon-to-be-dead character. As Black people, our national anthem is, "Just leave! Just leave! Don't save nobody! Don't go back and rescue that white girl! They're gonna kill you! Just leave!" We are a people written and ruined by trauma. We are a people requiring an apology and awaiting reimbursement. We are a people struggling to throw off the chains of slavery while being thousands of dollars and years and single-family homes and good neighborhoods and secure jobs and lifetimes and futures in debt. When white broadcast journalists and public radio hosts say that there are two Americas, believe them. Black is a country. Black is a country. Black is our country. As a parent, I, like many other parents, carry within me a deep sense of responsibility, of duty, to teach and love and protect my children, to share my own appreciation of delicious stories and Black music and world adventure and Asian food, to keep little fingers away from electrical outlets, to lock the comet away from curious tongues, to shape my children's sense of language, self, and belonging in the world. But unlike white parents who can shut out the dark, who have tools, weapons, to banish convenient and distant monsters and the luxury to protect their children from harm, both malignant and imaginary, I have to cause my children harm in preparation for the violence those same white parents and their white children will inflict upon them. For it is white people who imagine me and my children as their monsters and our Blackness that they require to function as an indicator of social death that cannot be moved unless we want to dismantle the order of the entire universe. And so I've had to be preemptive with my daughter, poisoning the gentleness of bedtime stories with abrupt details of what having a Black body can get you killed. What happened? They killed him and left his body in the street. Why? He turned and ran. He wouldn't get out of the car. Someone thought he had a gun. He was Black. After a while, the stories bleed together, but the thing that doesn't change is the color of the bodies. On car rides, my daughter has gotten used to the frantic chord of my voice as I tell her how white people will likely perceive her and how white people's perceptions, reinforced by the deadly force of the police, can never shape the interiority of our world. The clay and warm earth of our affection, the textured feel of our humor, the hollow, wet rot of our disappointed anger. I have even given her that word to hold. You know the one. She has had it now for some time, balanced in the palm of her hand like a small stone. Occasionally, she rolls it around, inspecting its shape and color. They will use it, I tell her, even if it never leaves their lips. I am aware that what I am doing is eroding the sweet outer baby skin of innocence, peeling it back layer by layer and letting it bleed a little underneath, knowing it will harden and callous, scar. But this is what it feels like to prepare one's child for a world in which they will always be unprotected. This is what innocence is for white people looks like. And if there's one thing worse than being Black in America, it is being an unprepared Black parent in America. Had I done nothing, how soon would it have been before they taught my daughter that she had no history, that her actions, identical to that of her white peers, were a problem? How soon would it have been before they gave her that word, pelting it into her back like a bullet, unconcerned with her talent, her potential, or her dreams? But you're telling me that at least my daughter would have had her innocence. Night. The most innocent time of the day, a time when we're supposed to let go of our anger. Before my daughter goes to bed, we lie together and read books about life beneath the ocean, the surface of planets, and the wishes and fears of talking animals, moving through imagined worlds where our bodies aren't targets or weapons, but warm, natural things. Sometimes we watch videos of astronauts giving tours of international space stations and marvel at how they brush their teeth and sleep in zero gravity. This is the sovereignty of quiet before sleep. A time when no one is suspiciously watching us shop in the grocery store aisle. No one is interrupting us and stealing our words, dismissing our pain. We are able to drink a cup of milk and undress and brush teeth and kiss and complain of the cold without thinking constantly, incessantly about what it means to be Black in America, to think about how complicated and terrible and beautiful and fragile it really is. We are able to simply concern ourselves with the immediate effort of dreaming. No long labor of explaining to others how we remain on the outside of freedom, no reminder of how lucky we are to be alive in a nation where there is nowhere safe. Just a house gradually filled with the sound of breathing. The slow rise and collapse of the chest. Our dreams unfurling all around us. Wild, rich, infinite.
That was Wendy Thompson Taiwo reading Black is a Country. And I saved that for the end because I just didn't know how much we would be able to say after hearing that. Such an amazing and powerful piece. Sarah Bellamy, your thoughts on hearing Wendy's voice and telling her story like that?
I think it's incredibly brave and incredibly moving. And I think it's really important that we think about how people are having to parent their children in this time. You know, one of my favorite writers, James Baldwin, once said, "American history is longer, larger, more various, more beautiful, and more terrible than anything anyone has ever said about it." And I think that's one of the things that this project does. You know, it's not to say that certain voices don't matter. It's to say all voices do. And we need to make room for everyone to be able to share their story.
So what exactly is going to happen tonight? You mentioned that there's going to be a panel discussion. Talk a little bit about what you hope to accomplish tonight.
Well, again, Penumbra is a space that intends to create dialogue. And so we're inviting Wing Young Huey, Sarah Schoenwald, Council Member Philippe Cunningham, Aaron Sharkey, and David Melendez to the table to talk about not just the work that we'll be hearing that evening, but their work in fostering more inclusive, loving, and compassionate communities, in remembering those who are often forgotten. And I know, because I've been at Penumbra for a long time, that the people who come tonight will want to engage and challenge and work together to think through that. And that is what Let's Talk is supposed to do. And I hope we all leave that room feeling a little emotionally drained, but excited about change.
And where do you see this going from here? I mean, we've talked about that My America project coming back in different iterations, but this particular project, this conversation, what do you see happening after tonight?
Well, I think what we're hoping these stories will do is motivate people to be more civically engaged. So if you feel moved tonight, if you feel moved by what you heard on the radio today, do the work to invite inclusion, do the work to invite love, do the work to invite courage into your community. Let's make the America we deserve. Let's roll up our sleeves. Let's do that hard work. And let's not sit back even when we're disappointed or frustrated. We need everyone to be involved.
Isabella, where do you go from here?
Good question. Again, I think I'm ready to, you know, have a wonderful experience tonight and then do whatever I can to continue having experiences very similar to this one in all walks of my life.
Now, I should note that, unfortunately, tonight is sold out.
It is, indeed.
So for people who are looking to hear more about this experience or to learn more, what do you encourage them to do?
Well, we'll be shortly including all of the stories on our website, so people will be able to listen to them there. You know, and I think, again, coming to more Let's Talks in the future, it's a quarterly series that we offer at Penumbra, and everybody is welcome. And then I would say look for another call for submission. I think we're, you know, this is a process I hope that we can continue at Penumbra.
Thanks so much to both of you for joining us this hour. I really appreciate it.